Hey guys, welcome to episode 238 of The True Crime Couple. I'm Kay.
And I'm John.
We hope that you're all doing well and that you're ready for another episode. If you are new to our Patreon family, first we want to say thank you. And we want you to stay tuned at the end of the episode for a personal shout out. And if you want ad-free episodes and two full-length bonus episodes a month, please join us at patreon.com/truecrimecouple. Okay, John, I think that concludes what we had to get through. So let's do what everyone likes and get right into the case. John, are you ready to hear something crazy?
Of course.
At 2 a.m., Kimberly Parker received a call from her friend, Latrice Curtis. Instead of hearing her friend's cheerful voice on the other line, she heard nothing. Latrice, she asked. Still nothing. Latrice? She listened intently in the darkness that surrounded her. She heard wind echoing off of the phone speaker, vehicles passing in the background, and footsteps on gravel. Hello, Latrice? But again, there was nothing. The call seemed wrong, everything about it. The time, the silence, but also the noises. Kimberly was frozen in fear, and all she could do was listen. 3 minutes passed, and her friend never came to the phone. The same sounds echoed over and over again. The wind, the cars, the footsteps.
Police say the suspect, 31-year-old Jeffrey Dahmer, has confessed to the killings of 11 people whose remains were found in his apartment.
We are all evil in some form or another, are we not?
Lock your doors, lock your windows. If you have the ability to provide additional security devices, then by all means do so.
On January 8th, 2008, early morning commuters traveled along the 26 miles of highway, known as Interstate 540, in Wake County. The stretch of road is known as the Raleigh Outer Loop, which allows those in the more suburban towns to loop around the county and avoid having to travel directly through the city. It was a quick way to get to work in Raleigh, so it was well-traveled. Stranded cars left behind by exasperated motorists were commonplace along the highway. Stranded cars left by exasperated motorists are commonplace on the North Carolina highways. So the drivers thought nothing of the abandoned white Nissan Sentra. But a little further on down the road, there was an object off in the hilly embankment. It looked like a human body, but that couldn't be true. Not there out in the open like that. So they continued on, thinking about their day ahead and running through their mental to-do lists. But not David Jones. He couldn't believe what he saw, and there was no way he would continue on without stopping to see if what he thought he saw was really there. What if it was a person? He was concerned that they needed help. So he pulled over on the side of the busy highway and approached the object. He said later that he was just left speechless. It was a human body, and they were far from any help that he or paramedics could ever perform. It was jarring, and he struggled to call 911 because he was truly in shock. With a shaky voice, he can be heard on the 911 call, asking for police to arrive. He described the area as being westbound on I-540, just past exit 20, the exit for Buffalo Road. "There is a body on the side of the road," he said. When first responders got there, they were shocked to find the body was out in the open, as reported. They really hadn't known what to expect. But nothing could have prepared them for the tragic scene they pulled up to. On the side of the highway, there was an expanse of dead winter grass that sloped up one small hill and then disappeared into a forest of tall pine trees. On the slope of that hill lay the body of a young African-American woman. She was fully dressed, but her legs were spread wide open, and her arms were outstretched above her head as she lay on her back. It looked almost as if she was in the process of making a snow angel. She had suffered from dozens of stab wounds, and long, deep slashes covered her neck, chest, and torso. It was clear why David Jones, while on the phone with 911, could tell that she had died without getting too near. She had obviously bled to death, as she was left pallid and cold. The gaping wounds that had been left by her attacker had long stopped bleeding. There was simply nothing left. When first responders arrived, they immediately sectioned off the area with police tape and called in the crime scene unit and detectives. Because the body was found on I-540 in Wake County, jurisdiction of the case went to them. When there's a murder that is investigated by the Wake County Sheriff's Department, the Wake County Bureau of Identification processes the crime scene and collects the forensic evidence. In this case, though, this would prove to be a two-crime scene area of investigation that would need to take place. Less than a mile up the road was a white Nissan Sentra. Inside the vehicle was a large amount of blood on and around the driver's seat, including the seatbelt, door panel, and glass. Their victim must have tried to get away, to try and go get help, or their body had been staged. It was a horrifying thought, having seen the amount of wounds she had suffered, if she had tried to get away from her attacker. But she must have been in excruciating pain either way.
What I think is crazy so far is that her body was in plain sight. So how did other people not stumble upon her before?
Well, they did. Other people had seen her body from where she was. If you're driving on the highway, she was a little ways off of the side of the road up a hill. So some people had seen her, but she kind of looked like an object in the grass to some. Some recognized that this was a body. So many calls had come in about the body on the side of the road, but David Jones was the only person who had stopped the vehicle.
Okay. I was going to ask, okay, were there anybody making phone calls, at least if they did recognize it?
Yeah, I mean, and Sometimes it's just like a traumatic thing to see, but it's also the bystander effect that we've talked about many times on this podcast and other podcasts have too. Sometimes you don't think that you have to call because you just assume other people are.
I get that. I just would never want to leave that to chance.
No, I would definitely call 911 if I found a body on the side of the road during my morning commute.
Who's to say that that person's not holding on to dear life and possibly you can save them? I mean, I know this is the extent of injuries, she's dead, but.
Well, you can't see that from the road. And that right. was David Jones's point and why he pulled over the car in case this person needed assistance.
I know it would be, slim to none, but at least you take that gamble and call.
Yeah, I would say so. Well, because of all these calls and police activity, and obviously this is going to be like said over the radios, the media presence is almost immediate because, how often does this happen? So in order to keep the integrity of the crime scene because of the arrival of the media, and obviously for the dignity of the victim and those who are passing by, the Bureau of Identification put up large tents and tarps so the body could not be photographed or filmed by news crews or seen by motorists. That was also not the way that the police wanted the victim's family to find out what had happened to their loved one.
I'm also glad to hear that, because there's times that that doesn't happen and they find out via social media or on TV or what have you.
Right.
So I'm glad, because you don't want to hear from random sources like that. I think.
Or if they're filming to see the body of your loved one.
And, they don't always redact images of dead bodies right away. No. Sometimes they do leak. You don't want your family member to be exposed like that.
Yeah, that would be on the internet. Yeah. It's 2008, so not as prevalent as it is today, but it was definitely happening on websites.
Oh, sure. You can definitely go to websites even back then and find the most disturbing photos and videos.
So identification was assumed at that point. The investigators, of course, would need there to be an official identification, but they felt like they knew who their victim was. The plates on the vehicle belonged to 21-year-old Latrice Mitrell Curtis. Just a short inquiry into their database showed that a call had been placed earlier that morning by Darren Curtis, the husband of Latrice. The couple lived in an apartment on River Shadow Court in Raleigh. He was in the National Guard, and Latrice was an accounting student at North Carolina Central University. Latrice commuted to and from school, which was about a 35-minute drive. What was a little confusing about the position, though, of her body and car and where she was, which was westbound on I-540, was that that would be the direction of her driving home. So now they're going to assume that this attack most likely probably happened the night prior because of the exsanguination that the victim suffered or loss of blood. That would have taken hours to have taken place. Plus, if she was on her way home, it would have made sense that that was later in the evening versus early in the morning, unless she had stayed at the university overnight. But their assumption would be correct.
You know, her wounds are also pretty interesting because it's almost as if the point of it was for her to potentially die slow. Maybe I'm wrong, but the injuries on the neck and stuff and her like bleeding the way that she, the way that they found her, it does seem like, you know, deliberate.
Well, it seemed like the person really wanted her to suffer.
Yeah.
It was definitely a frenzied, violent attack. We know that knife attacks are personal, often aggressive. Obviously aggressive, but you know what I mean? Like there is like this like visceral intent to cause as much harm as possible.
Right.
Emotions are always at play. So that's the kind of things that are associated with knife attacks like this one.
And also speaking of deliberate, I mean, what a place to leave a body.
Right.
It's really just the display factor of it. That's odd to me, unless she somehow crawled over there or, you know, after being violently attacked, made her way over that way, maybe. I don't know, but it's weird. So if it is deliberate, what a place to display her there like that.
Yes, for all to see.
Yes.
And the way that she was displayed, it was almost to cause shame to the victim. So when Darren Curtis, who is the victim's husband, reported her missing, he told the Wake County 911 dispatcher that he had awoken that morning, January 30th, and found that his wife had not come home that night. He said that he had received a phone call from her around 10 p.m. She was driving in her car, and she told him that she was on her way home, but that she was going to stop for something to eat. He couldn't say where she had been in her journey or where she had stopped to eat. He said that after the phone call, he fell asleep, and he just realized that she had not come home minutes before he called 911. An APB was put out on Latrice's vehicle, which was a white Nissan Sentra. So that's why they are knowing that this is their victim. And now that they have the details of the 911 call, the detectives also know that she was on her way home, and they don't know what happened after that. Something must have made her pull over.
Yeah.
Darren was notified by the Wake County Sheriff's Office and was asked to come down to the Wake County Sheriff's Station. He did, and they broke the news to him that Latrice may have been found dead, but they would need him to identify her body as he was her next of kin, as her husband. He confirmed that it was his wife found. So also in Raleigh, Sherman Jones was only peripherally aware of the scene that unfolded on I-540 with the found body as it echoed from the television because he had his own problems to worry about. His daughter Latrice was not answering the phone, and it was very unlike her not to call him or his wife. He had tried to call her several times, but each call had been unsuccessful. Next, he tried to call Darren, his son-in-law, albeit reluctantly, because he didn't necessarily get along with him, but he did. And there was no response. Finally, Sherman thought to call North Carolina Central University to see if maybe his daughter was in class or if something had happened there. When he called with his inquiry, he was patched through to the security office of the university. By that time, the Wake County Sheriff's Department had already informed them about the identification. so the university could process and handle the news of the tragic attack. They had basically already made contact with the family, which was Darren. So her father hadn't been called, or her mother. The man at the security office that was on the phone with Sherman told him that it would be best to call the Wake County Sheriff's Department. And he was confused by this. And the statement, of course, put him on guard. And he asked, why would I have to do that? But he relented and called because he needed to know where his daughter was. Daughters are always special to their fathers, or they should be. But Latrice was something else entirely to her father. She was his everything. And even though she was married and about to graduate with an accounting degree, she would forever be his baby. The girl that could melt even the coldest of hearts with a smile and her personality. The little girl who followed underfoot, wanting to do everything he did. The little girl he took fishing and hunting. The little girl that he gave every experience he could to. The little girl who he taught to play basketball. Their bond was strong and it ran deep. And even though through her teen years, Latrice's interest changed and she got into more age-appropriate or more feminine things, she was still his little girl that would play basketball and go fishing with him. Sherman would do anything for her, even though at this time he was a bit mad at her. When Latrice went away to college at North Carolina Central University, he cried like a baby. And so did she, even though it wasn't that far away. Sherman expected his daughter to have fun and do normal college things. But he would have never thought that one day, in the spring semester of her junior year, that she would come home married.
There's a lot to say there. Okay. I will just tell you that I normally am not one to cry, right? Or let things get me teary-eyed. But now that we have Ryan, it's changed the whole thing for me. You reading that paragraph and me here, you know, just me listening to it. It's so true. It does rain true because for 16 months, I've been everything, little things she does, every word she says, all that stuff. It's very touching and it makes you want to maybe a little tear to come out.
John has shed many tears, guys.
You're right. But I guess what I'm trying to get at is I feel what he's saying. I'm not there yet. But I feel this,
yes.
Which is even that much harder to listen to.
Because you know the fate.
Yeah. And secondly, I would not like if Ryan in her, you know, junior year was to tell me, hey, I'm getting married.
Yes.
I would not be cool with that. So I, on many levels, like I feel how he feels a little bit. You know, as far as the empathy of this goes, so.
Well, Latrice's family found out that she had eloped with Darren Curtis on April 27th, 2007. This had been a shock to the family because they didn't even know that the couple was dating.
Wow. Okay.
Yes.
Now I know why there's issues and why they don't get along. Okay. Right.
Yes, exactly.
Gotcha.
Sherman later reflected that he thought his daughter had kept it from the family because of how protective they were of her. And although everyone was upset that there was no wedding to attend, no celebration had, and of course Sherman was upset that Darren had never asked for his daughter's hand in marriage, they all stayed close and were trying to get over the shock of it all because they didn't want to lose her.
Right. And I think that's at that point you're in that mode where it's already done with. She's not going to change her mind. Yes. I have to try to roll with this. So
Darren was a nice and respectful man, and he and Latrice seemed to be matched very well, a great couple. So it made it easy, but, you know, alone, Sherman, very comfortable with his daughter because they had a close relationship, would have talks with her about her decision she was making. And it was that she was very young, but he would just say, like, I'm worried about you. Like, what'd you go and do that for? Like, what are you doing? But he still loved and respected her, but he was just kind of like, what the heck?
Yeah. I mean, listen, some people do find that to be at this point archaic, but like, I think it's a very nice thing for somebody to ask, you know, ask for their daughter's hand in marriage.
And especially now that you have a daughter.
Exactly, right? Yeah, 100%. And I think that in his situation right now, yeah, behind closed doors, he's probably like cursing up a storm.
Yes.
And he's probably extremely irate over it.
I really think it's based on the situation of the family. So in most cases, I think it's respectful and nice and allows you to be welcomed into the family to ask permission. But if there's like not a really good relationship going on between parents and daughter or father and daughter, I think it's fine if permission is not asked. But here they had a very close relationship. So I think it would have gone a long way in the long term, but they're just two young kids who excitedly got married one day.
I disagree with you a little bit.
Yeah?
I do. I think that even if things are not quite calm among all parties, I think you still ask. Because the hope is that eventually, by asking, that's a sign of good faith and that you're a mature man.
Okay.
In my eyes. And that you're willing even to take the, you know, to take that hit, because you know you're not going to be met with anything nice.
Right.
You know, but at least doing it shows in good faith that you're here for the long haul, you care about the daughter, and you care about the family's feelings. Well, that's my hope, you know, and hopefully that works out that way.
Oh, yeah. Before you marry our daughter, you have to listen to all 268 episodes of
all of them. Prepare yourself.
And join Patreon.
Yes. Why not?
Okay. Well, before we get into the story any further, I want to stop here and talk about our first sponsor of today's show, Vinted. In the past year, we've been so immersed in having our sweet little girl. But now that Ryan's older and we've emerged from the newborn phase, I realized, wow, we've got to take care of this house. So this summer, I've been trying to declutter. And the biggest thing that I had to tackle was our closet. So I had to enlist the help of John. John and I have so many clothes and not a lot of closet space. So we purged. And as we were removing everything that we no longer wore, the pile just got bigger and bigger until we couldn't even see each other over it. And I thought, wow, some of these things we never even wore. So maybe we could earn a little bit of extra money. And that is what led me to Vinted. Vinted is a secondhand app that makes it easy for everyday sellers, people like you and me, to sell pre-loved fashion and earn some extra money. Vinted was so fun and easy to use, and the success I had with the app was so encouraging that it had me list more things. And the success that I had with the app was so kind of addictive and encouraging that I listed more and more things after the first. And now our closet is clutter-free. And I don't feel guilty about all of that money I spent on the clothes I hardly wore. On Vinted, there are no seller fees, and the app is free to download. Once you do, you will find that Vinted has a simple selling experience that is very quick and easy. And once an item sells, Vinted creates a prepaid shipping label for you. So, are you ready to clean out your closet and make some extra money? Download the Vinted app for free and start listing. With no seller fees, you keep every dollar you earn. And for a limited time, enjoy free shipping in the U.S. on Vinted. Remember, downloading the app is free, no seller fees, and free shipping in the U.S. for a limited time. Okay, let's get back to the show. By the time Sherman Jones called the Wake County Sheriff's Department, it was around 10 a.m. He was told that it would probably be best for him and his wife, Cynthia, to come down to the station. As the couple drove towards the fate that they inevitably knew they would have to meet, they did not share one word with each other, because there's really only one reason they're asking them to come in. They arrived at the station just after 11 a.m., It was there that the detective broke the news to them that Latrice, their daughter, had been found on I-540 earlier that morning. Their minds must have flashed back in intertwined memories of the news footage that they saw that day, and Latrice as their sweet tomboy, who grew up to be a beautiful and intelligent woman. It didn't make sense. Why? How? Where was Darren? The detectives couldn't answer the first two questions for the grieving parents, but the last one was easy. Darren was also currently at the sheriff's headquarters being questioned in an interrogation room, not too far from where they sat. Darren told the detectives, questioning him, the same thing that he had told the 911 operator. He had called to report his wife missing that morning. He said that Latrice had called him the night before to tell him that she was on her way home and that she had been in the car when she did so. He knew this because he could hear the radio on in the background. He fell asleep waiting on her to get home, and he got up between 6 and 7 a.m. Once he noticed that she had not come home, he called 911 because he was very worried. Latrice did tell him that she would stop somewhere for something to eat, but she didn't say where she was going to stop. He could not even tell them where she would stop because when he spoke with her, he was unaware of where she was in the 35-minute journey that it would have taken her to get home. Darren voluntarily submitted his DNA for testing against any evidence that they would find at the scenes or on Latrice. He also got fingerprinted and allowed for pictures to be taken of his hands, arms, and upper body without his shirt on. Now, this was to see if any injuries were present. There were not. Despite the fact that Darren did this, Latrice's parents were very upset with him. They did not like the fact that he had fallen asleep and not waited up for their daughter. They did not like the fact that he had not called them to tell them about this. And Sherman shared that on that day and the many days to come, he and Cynthia actually didn't hear from Darren at all. And it was something that they thought to be very strange and a little disrespectful.
Yeah, I mean, I have to be honest with you. I find it odd that, you know, he did not reach out to the parents right away as soon as he was privy to the information. Yeah. I think that that part of it's disrespectful. I think it's actually very forthcoming of him to give voluntarily all of that stuff because that would 100% rule him out of him physically committing the crime. Not necessarily, you know, there's other ways and avenues that
right.
he could be involved, but at least physically he, you know, if it, you know, deems to be clear, then he didn't do it physically. But the other stuff to this is they obviously don't like him from the get-go.
Right.
So I don't expect him to be waiting up for her. You know, that's like a hard ask. We don't know. That guy could have had the hardest day at work and he came home and fell asleep.
Right.
You know, like, I think that that's a little too much. But the rest of it, like, I understand.
I get saying like, oh, it's weird you didn't wake up in the middle of the night and be like, oh, is she home? But him falling asleep is like pretty much a normal thing to happen, especially because she was a student at the university who often came home late. So that was a part of their normal routine that he would fall asleep before she would get home.
Exactly. You know, so I don't know about all that. But as far as not letting them know about what happened, yes, a very odd, not the right thing to do. And I would understand why their antennas would be up on that.
Right. And it's so funny you say that because next I have written, I also think they were predisposed to be suspicious of him because they never really necessarily approved of him and their daughter. And Sherman has said in interviews, now, not that I necessarily believe this, but I think that it's important to say what the father of our victim thinks. But he believes that Latrice died on his watch. So that's why he's really upset with him about that. And I think that just comes from him wanting to protect his little girl, you know?
Right. Also, when something bad happens, you know, you do want somebody to blame.
It's a lot easier if there's someone to blame.
Yeah, it is easier. I mean, I'm not faulting the family here at all. I'm just saying, like, we don't have, at this point, we're just as in the dark as the parents. So we don't know what his involvement is or isn't, you know, right. Like, we don't know. So I think at this point, they're just so devastated and so distraught that the only thing that they could do is blame the one person that they're not really fond of at the moment.
Yeah, and I think there's another reason why they're frustrated as well. Sherman and Cynthia were very upset that night while they were at the sheriff's station because they had asked to see Latrice's body, but they were told that they could not because Darren was technically the only next of kin. So they would have to wait for her body to be released, which would take some time because an autopsy needed to be performed. So this was something that obviously angered them all over again about the marriage. So I think that added to some like fuel to the fire.
No, that's a big deal, because what you're essentially doing is cutting them off from every avenue of
their daughter.
So, okay. I mean, that's another kind of big detail to know.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, it is an interesting dynamic, but the Joneses believed that Latrice had been murdered by Darren. And they certainly hated him for what had happened. Although the police shared in their suspicions with the family, they didn't believe that he was as involved as vehemently as they did. But they had to admit, he is the husband. And it tends to just be them a lot of the times. So another thing that is going to aid in the police being suspicious of Darren was that he didn't have an alibi. All he claimed was that he was at the apartment that he shared with Latrice alone and had been asleep. There was no one to verify that. So that left the time for him to do whatever he wanted until he called 911 the following morning. He also was the last person to have spoken with her. They didn't know what was said on that conversation, so she could have shared with him where she was going to eat or where she was stopping. It's something they would never know. However, there was some information learned early on that made them question if it had been Darren. First, they believed his reactions to be genuine. The grief, the confusion, and if he was faking it, he was a great actor. But more than that, there was the minivan. At 1:15 p.m., State Trooper Isaac Cooper with the Highway Division contacted the Wake County Sheriff's Department to let them know that he had seen the vehicle involved in the murder, the white Nissan Sentra, in the early morning hours of January 30th. So he had come upon that car. He said it had to have been around 1:15 a.m. when he spotted the vehicle. Parked behind it was a minivan.
Okay, on the side of the road.
Yes.
Okay.
The minivan had its hazards on and the windshield wipers were going. Now, this is not completely odd that the wipers were on because there was a light wintry mix falling from the sky. But it made it look like the driver of the van had gotten out in a hurry. So both vehicles were empty when he got there. He wrote down the plates of both vehicles and shone a flashlight inside. Cooper said he had not observed blood, so the attack had not happened yet. But just as he was about to investigate further, thinking that maybe the two owners of the vehicles had gone into the woods or they were walking on the highway because of the breakdown or something, he was called away from the scene.
Are you kidding me?
Yes.
No way.
He could not go back in time to stop the murder from happening, but he could provide the plates. And that was a big deal to investigators. But he could have stopped it.
But what are the odds of that?
I know.
Wow.
But what's great is, at least he wrote down the plate number.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
The plates belong to 43-year-old Robert Reeves, whose address was located in Durham, North Carolina, the city where the university Latrice attended was located. Detectives needed to find out who Robert Reeves was. But before they could do that, they were contacted by a woman named Kimberly. Remember Kimberly from the top of the show, the intro?
Yes.
She got that phone call. Kimberly said that she had just found out that Latrice had been murdered. She thought she had some information for them. She was really good friends with Latrice, and the two of them had worked together for quite some time. Kimberly said that the night before, well, into the early morning hours, Latrice had called her. She'd been sleeping when her phone rang at 2:07 a.m. She said that Latrice had never called that late and would never really do something like that unless there was an important reason to do so. So she picked up out of concern for her friend. When she did, no one was there. She almost hung up, but then she heard sounds, like someone was close to passing cars. She also heard wind and footsteps on gravel. but everything was so distant that it was hard to make out. But now this all makes sense, especially after she found out her friend had been discovered on a highway.
Okay, I mean, that's big.
Yes, and it does correlate with what the state trooper is going to say, because if he came across both vehicles at 1:15 a.m., but there was no sign of blood in the Sentra, then that meant the attack hadn't happened yet. So it would make sense that at 2:07, this phone call came in, and this is most likely when the attack was taking place. She most likely was hearing either the murder of her friend or the aftermath of it.
My God.
Kimberly called out desperately for her friend, she told them, to say something, but she never did. It felt wrong to her in many ways. Wrong that her friend would have called her at that time. She also was nervous that she was hanging on the line because she was like, well, did she call me by accident and now I'm listening to some private moment of hers? So because of that nervousness and thinking of like, oh, this was a butt dial and I don't want to intrude on her, that's why she hung up the phone. And she wasn't really sure that it was anything bad. I mean, looking back, it makes sense, but only with the information she has currently about how she was attacked. So she said that's why after 3 minutes she hung up and didn't act on it afterwards because she really wasn't too sure what she had heard.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, most people, if someone does pocket dial you, I mean, you're not going to linger.
I mean, sometimes I do because I'm like, are they going to say something?
You know, I believe that 100% that you probably would do that. Well, I know that I would just be like, hello, hello. And then after a little while, just hang up.
I'm not saying a long time. I'm not saying like 3 minutes.
No, Kay would be there for 15 minutes.
This 5 hour phone call.
I don't throw it past you, but. Yeah, it's very normal. I don't think that's out of the norm, you know, in a situation like that.
No. I do always, every time, like, we're talking about someone, I always check my phone.
I know.
Just in case. You never know.
I mean, I guess it's a pretty it's a decent habit to have.
Everyone does it, I bet. All right. So the detectives know that this is the last phone call that Latrice placed because they did find her cell phone near her body. So the information's helpful from Kimberly because she can tell them what she had heard. That was something they wouldn't have been able to tell. So they were glad that she came forward with that information and definitely saved them a lot of time in the investigation.
I'm sure it's also good as like a way to like figure out times because you have a timestamp of the phone call coming in.
Yeah. The only thing they weren't aware of was whether this was during the murder or afterwards.
Right.
So it didn't take long before the detectives did get an answer about something. And what that was who Robert Reeves was. They found out that Reeves was a well-respected member of the Living in Favor Global Network of Churches in Goldsboro, North Carolina.
So he's like a pastor?
A bishop.
Oh.
Yes, he was a bishop of the Pentecostal Church. And oversaw many of the churches because there's numerous amounts of them. He taught and ordained new ministers, and he served as the preacher of the congregation. He was very high-ranking and very well-respected. So what was his van doing parked behind their murder victim's car at 1 in the morning?
I don't think you'd find normally a bishop at the side of the road at 1 a.m., you know?
No, not trying to get new congregants, you know. That's not really the right time.
I don't think so, no.
Unless he was just being nice, trying to assist a motorist who was in need. But it would be odd that he would be on the road at 1 a.m. Darren and Latrice's family were asked if they knew the man or attended those churches. And they all said no. They were not members of that congregation. Nor did they know Reeves. Sherman Jones did say that his daughter had always been into and curious about religion, so he could see her having a conversation with him, but he didn't know about on the side of the road at like 1 a.m.
Yeah, I mean, that's, yeah.
Odd. Robert Reeves was found and brought in for questioning at 3 p.m. on the day of discovery, January 30th. So a lot's happening really quickly in this investigation. Detectives described him as being a very confident and well-spoken man who seemed to be one that could command a room. all traits you would expect of a church bishop. He was not emotional or angry about the lines of questions or accusations. Rather, he stayed even-keeled. He told the detectives that people usually referred to him as the bishop. Well, the bishop was very cooperative, and he assured them that he would be able to explain it all. He was always one to give help to those in need, especially younger people, as they needed the most help and guidance towards the correct direction. One such young man that he had wanted to help was a man named Stephen Randolph. Randolph had needed a place to stay at a low cost, so Reeves told him that he could rent his basement apartment for a cheap price or a reduced rate. Randolph was a student at North Carolina Central University, and he played basketball for them as well. So Randolph's car had been at the shop, so Reeves had allowed him to use his vehicle to help him get to and from school and practice. So he said he wasn't using the van at the time. So if the van had been anywhere at 1 in the morning, it was most likely because of Stephen Randolph.
Okay. I just want to make an observation. I don't know what it is. I don't like when people refer to themselves like with a nickname like that. Like by title like that? Like maybe it's me. Maybe the problem is me. But anytime when we talk about like religion and stuff, or people that are in the like these roles that are very, very powerful and influential, that's a red flag, instant red flag to me. Like my antennas are going crazy because I don't like anybody that uses their position and then like has their own title for themselves. Though you are a bishop,
you're not the bishop.
I feel it's. I don't know.
It's also very interesting that he calls himself the bishop, only because there's so many other bishops, because it's such a large community of churches. It's not just one church. So it is interesting. And I see what you're saying. It's just he's giving himself
power.
Power.
Okay, and that's not what religion is.
Through the nickname.
Right. Like, I'm not saying a red flag, like, I think he's guilty of something. I just think it's a red flag in his character. Maybe it's a gray flag, actually. I mean, a beige flag, actually.
Okay.
You know, because it's a weird character thing. I was like,
are we coming up with a new color?
Well, gray?
No, beige makes sense. Gray.
No, but it's a beige flag on his personality, maybe? That there's something there that's not quite bishop-like.
Okay.
You know?
I could see that.
And then I feel like even having this person stay with him, even that is bizarre to me. Almost as if he's not really, like, he does things to cover up, like, what true intentions he might have.
Yeah.
Once again, I'm not saying he's our suspect or anything. I'm just saying I could see right through this guy already. Okay. That he uses religion as like, a cover. So I don't like that. I spot it from a mile away.
Okay.
It's the BS radar.
So you're not a fan of the bishop?
No. But not for the murder, just his character.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, the bishop is going to say that if they had questions about where the van was that night, that those questions should be directed towards Stephen Randolph. And they asked him what he had done the night before to kind of get an alibi. And he said that he had gone to church earlier that night, and then he returned to his home. He shared his home with his sister in addition to Stephen Randolph, but she lived upstairs with him and he in the basement. He said that she could confirm his alibi that night. Robert Reeves, same as Darren, had agreed to submit to a DNA sample and fingerprints, as well as for himself to be pictured. The pictures revealed no wounds to his person. What Reeves told them made sense, because at first the detectives were confused about the connection between a 43-year-old bishop and a 21-year-old student. But Latrice went to the same school as Stephen Randolph, so obviously it was him that she knew. Reluctantly, Robert Reeves admitted that he knew just how Randolph and Latrice knew each other. He said that the two of them were having a sexual relationship.
Whoa. But she's married.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so that's the connection.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So although Reeves didn't pan out to be the suspect they once thought he was going to be, it seemed like he was flipping the investigation on its head and giving them a huge lead. Because now we know that the victim was having an affair. They had not thought that Darren Curtis had any motive to harm his wife, but they just found out that he did.
Right. And funny enough, that's kind of now, like, everything's being pieced together. Now we have not just motive, but we have like the crime itself, like we said earlier, meant to be found.
Posed a certain way. For humiliation.
Yes. Maybe.
For everyone to see.
Maybe because Darren was jealous. Maybe he found out. And maybe, you know, that's a possibility. And in a rage because of jealousy, committed the ultimate betrayal act.
But this also rang true for Stephen Randolph, the man that they had to question. Could the affair have led to a heated confrontation in some way? Because Stephen Randolph was also dating somebody else. It was possible.
So they got, like, this is worse than a triangle. This is like a
square.
A square.
Well, because it could be the husband. It could be the boyfriend. But it could be the owner of the minivan.
What, the bishop?
Maybe.
I mean, I guess it really could be anybody because this is a massive love square.
Or the girlfriend.
Could be a woman, too.
Yeah. But now what they would need to do was bring in Stephen Randolph for questioning and speak to him about the truth of his relationship with Latrice. But before we do that, what I want to do is I want to take a quick break and talk about the final sponsor of today's show, Rula. Have you ever looked back on a difficult period in your life and thought, I really could have used someone to talk to back then? Maybe it was after a major loss, stressful season at work, or one of those times when anxiety seemed to be piling up faster than you could manage it. For a lot of people, the hardest part isn't deciding to get help. It's actually finding help. And if you've ever tried searching for a therapist who accepts your insurance, you know how frustrating that process can be. Affordable and accessible mental health care shouldn't feel out of reach. We use our insurance benefits to take care of our physical health all the time. So why shouldn't we be able to use those same benefits to take care of our mental health? That's why I want to tell you about Rula. Finding a therapist is hard enough. Finding one who actually takes your insurance is where a lot of online therapy platforms fall short. Many don't accept insurance at all, leaving you to pay full cost out of pocket or sign up for an expensive monthly subscription. But Rula does things differently. Rula partners with over 100 insurance plans, making the average copay just $15 per session. And depending on your benefits, it could be as little as $0. That's real therapy from licensed professionals at a price that actually makes sense. What I love is that Rula focuses on helping you find the right therapist, not just the first one available. They take into account your goals, preferences, and background, and provide a curated list of licensed in-network therapists who align with what you're looking for. Because finding the right fit can make all the difference. And it doesn't stop there. Rula supports you through your entire mental health journey, helping with everything from finding a provider to scheduling appointments and tracking your progress along the way. They even offer access to both therapists and psychiatrists, making it easier to get the care you need, whether that's therapy, medication management, or both. No wait lists, no frustrating back and forth. Appointments can be available as soon as tomorrow. Thousands of people are already using Rula to get affordable, high-quality therapy that's actually covered by insurance. Visit rula.com/TCC. to get started. That's rula.com/TCC. You deserve mental health care that works with you, not against your budget. Okay, let's get back to the show. Latrice's friends and family were asked about Stephen Randolph before their questioning of him began. However, no one said that they knew who he was or that Latrice had been having an affair. Rather, they were shocked to learn that detail because they would have never pegged her as that kind of person that would have done that. Her friend Kimberly, the woman that had received the phone call from the night before, said that she thought Latrice didn't say anything to anyone because she was probably scared that she would get judged for making a decision like that. The detail of the affair broke her parents' hearts, not because they were upset with her, but because they were concerned for her and all that she had going on in her life and the fact that she wasn't sharing it with anyone. Her father said that he would have been stern when talking to her about it because she had grown up knowing right from wrong, and that was most definitely wrong. However, he would have emotionally been there for his daughter because she was clearly going through something. And thus concluded the discovery and first day of the investigation into the murder of Latrice Curtis, which is one heck of a day of investigating. The following morning, the detectives received the autopsy results from the North Carolina office of the chief medical examiner in Chapel Hill. They knew Latrice's cause of death were the several stab wounds that she had, but nothing could have prepared them for the detailed version that had the entirety of the sheer violence of the attack. The official cause of death was listed as multiple sharp force injuries. Including all injuries, Latrice had been stabbed almost 40 times, with 20 of those wounds being severe and deep. Numerous large stab wounds included the area of her right ear, her neck, her chest, and her abdomen. This would be consistent with someone having stabbed her while she sat in the driver's seat, which blood evidence backed up. The wounds in her neck were described as being catastrophic, as they severed her right carotid artery, left jugular vein, and her larynx. Her voice box had also been sliced and would have rendered her unable to scream for help.
That is so sad.
And again, because we still don't know when or why this phone call occurred, it might have been the reason she couldn't talk to her friend.
Oh my God. Those pieces do make sense, but whether or not they are, you know,
at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is another thing, you know?
We still don't know exactly when that phone call took place.
Exactly.
One of the stab wounds to her chest had punctured one of her lungs. And in addition to the stab wounds, there was also evidence of blunt force trauma. Latrice had bruising and abrasions all throughout her body, which were consistent with self-defense wounds. To support the detail that Latrice desperately fought for her life, were the cuts to her hands, where she had tried to block the knife, making contact with her body as best as she could, and two broken fingernails from fighting so hard against her attacker. This had been a violent attack, filled with rage and violence. So, who would have had the motive to be so angry with Latrice? Because that's all they saw there, was pure rage at that attack. Latrice was found on the embankment, though, and that was something the detectives really needed to think about, not in her vehicle where the majority of the attack took place. So they had more of like a feeling like her body was posed versus her having tried to get away from her attacker in her final moments and then them just leaving her like that. They thought it was more of a posing that happened to humiliate her in front of a lot of people. Now, because her jeans were unbuttoned and unzipped, a sexual assault exam was performed during her autopsy. During that exam, a condom was recovered from inside her vaginal canal. There was semen in the condom and the vaginal canal, and that was tested. Finally, there was a toxicology report, which came back negative for any drugs or alcohol in her system.
Wow. Were they able to test, or I'm sorry, compare the samples that were given to what they found, the semen they found in the condom?
Well, at this point, they only have the DNA samples of her husband, Darren Curtis, and Robert Reeves. So they are going to be compared to the two of them, but they are off to go speak to Stephen Randolph, and they were hoping to get DNA samples from him too, but they would have to be voluntary at this point.
Okay.
So they were sent in to be tested. Hopefully they would get one more source to test it against. Now, after these harrowing details of the attack, the news reports of the murder of Latrice Curtis only are going to intensify as some of them are released, not all. The following day, February 1st, 2008, the detectives tracked down Stephen Randolph and asked him to come in for a conversation, and he agreed to do so. Before the questioning, he was asked if he would submit his DNA and fingerprints to be compared to the crime scene, and he agreed. So now they were going to test all three men's DNA sample against what was found at the scene.
So they were waiting for all the samples to come in then to test them all?
No, they had sent the two in that they'd already received. But if you remember, it's only a difference of maybe 8 hours between when they got Stephen Randolph's DNA sample and the other two men.
Okay, gotcha.
Because it was only just the day before, which was the day of discovery. So everything was kind of all new and sent over to the lab at very similar times. Now, in addition to the semen being found in her vaginal canal and in the condom, they also are going to find DNA beneath her broken fingernails.
Oh, okay. That's good.
So all of that will be tested. Same as the other men, Stephen Randolph is going to pose for pictures that displayed his hands, arms, and torso area. The pictures, just as was the case with Darren Curtis and Robert Reeves, were absent of any markings, cuts, or scratches. An interesting detail, based on what the detectives now knew about what the murder had looked like, all three of their suspects had not one mark on them, but Latrice had fought for her life.
That is odd, because you would think that there would be some kind of markings on them if someone was, you know, obviously trying their hardest to survive. You're going to see scratches and cuts and bruises. You're going to see something.
Right.
The fact that all those men have nothing is so odd to me.
It's very puzzling. Now, Stephen Randolph explained that he was a student and basketball player at North Carolina Central University. His hopes were to be picked up by a larger school, like UNC or Duke, which was not entirely outside the realm of possibilities because North Carolina Central itself was a Division I school, a smaller Division I school, but Division I nonetheless. And they were near enough those universities that it had happened before that those universities had picked up players from Central. They asked him about Latrice and his alibi for the night. He admitted that he and Latrice were having an affair. She was married, and he himself had a girlfriend. However, he said, there was never really any talk of leaving their respective partners. It was more of just a physical relationship, and neither of them talked about their partners. It was just kind of a thing. He said that night, after school, Latrice had come over to the basement apartment he lived in, and the two of them had sex. It was not the best experience. Because afterwards, he said the condom that they were using got stuck inside of Latrice.
Oh.
And they were unable to retrieve it. Now, she was in a panic after this because there were talks. Some friends said that Latrice was talking about having children. Obviously, that would be with Darren Curtis. So they might have been trying. And if this happened, that would have been a really big deal because then the paternity of the child, if she were to conceive, would have been in question. So she was very upset about this having taken place. So she left in a panic when this took place. And she said she needed to drive home, even though they hadn't retrieved the condom, because she was already late getting home to Darren. And he said he just assumed that somewhere on the way home, she was going to stop and try to take it out again.
Okay, I would hope so.
Well, she has to.
Yeah, yeah.
Before she gets home.
I mean, that is crazy, though. But hey, listen, for all you know, this guy's telling us this story just to cover him as to why his now DNA is inside her.
And a condom.
And yes.
Right, because only he would know that.
Exactly.
Right. Randolph said that after Latrice left his apartment, he got ready and went over to his girlfriend's house, where all of their friends were hanging out and where he said he stayed for the remainder of the night. So, yeah, although that makes total sense that he's talking about this sexual experience that they had and he knows that detail, so then now he's covering it up to make it look like he wasn't the person to have done that to Latrice, he also has a rock-solid alibi from multiple people, but people that are also his friends. So confusing. Every time they get somewhere, they get sent back too.
Well, I mean, it's funny that you say that, like, that they're his friends, so the alibi is, like, kind of shaky. But you could say the same thing about, you know,
Robert Reeves.
Yes, exactly, because that was his sister. So it's kind of the same thing, exactly. If you think about it.
Darren's the only one who's honest. It's like, I was
Darren's alone. Like, there was nobody here. I was sleeping.
Not a good alibi.
No, definitely not.
The detectives were thinking many things. First, this would be a good alibi if it could be confirmed. Second, the fact that he had a girlfriend could mean that this was an act of jealousy. Maybe his girlfriend had something to do with the murder of Latrice. So they would have to confirm her alibi as well. But their alibis were each other. Then there was the incident with the condom. Was Randolph trying to excuse away the evidence of a sexual assault by saying that they had consensual sex and the condom got stuck? Or did this explain why Latrice had pulled over or told Darren that she needed to stop for food because she had to perform the task before she got home? And maybe why her pants had been unbuttoned and unzippered. Additionally, this could potentially be a motive for both Darren Curtis and Stephen Randolph. Darren, because his wife had been having an affair, and Stephen for two reasons. First, if Latrice wanted to prove that she and Stephen were having an affair, she could because she now had a condom with his sperm inside of it. Additionally, we all know how Division I sports players feel. They always think they're going to be the ones to make it big. The NBA, the NFL. Could he have thought that maybe this would hinder his goals? The fact that now someone could potentially be pregnant.
Yes, maybe no.
It's just potential motives.
I don't know. Yeah, I know. No, it's good to filter. It is good to filter things out, but it's also good to have these things laid out because for some people, it's a motive to commit murder. Like, this person's going to, you know, be the roadblock of me having a career. For some, as crazy as it sounds, that's enough. This is like a weird question, but where were they doing these sexual...
In his apartment.
But isn't that the apartment that he shared with the other guy?
Well, yes, but he lives in the basement apartment, whereas Robert Reeves and his sister live in the house itself.
Okay. But it's still technically it's under private. The same roof. But it's yes. Private.
Correct. Okay.
All right. I'm just asking because I would imagine that would be so bizarre, you know, if like somebody could hear you because they live in the same house as you.
Well, I'm sure it's happened to many people who share walls.
True.
Because this is a very large lead and led to many what-if scenarios, the investigators had uniformed officers already verifying the alibi of Stephen Randolph as he sat there in the interrogation room. So people were sent out to talk to all of the friends and his girlfriend that were there that night. And they confirmed that he was. They needed to corroborate what he was saying to believe him. And as they continued to question him, they asked whether or not his girlfriend knew about the affair. And he talked to them very truthfully about the whole entire situation. But then he said something that was very interesting to them. He said a little over a month before the murders took place, his tires were slashed. Now, he didn't know why, but it would be expensive to fix. And as a student who really couldn't work because of the grueling athletic schedule he had to maintain, he really couldn't afford that expense. He explained this is why Robert Reeves let him borrow the minivan, but explained that he had not been driving it that night. And even though Reeves let him drive the minivan, he didn't have sole usage of it.
I mean, that is a very big deal to find out because we know for a fact that that minivan, right, was parked behind that car on the side of the road.
Yes.
Now, it just sucks because it's like, who was driving it the night where the cop pulled up on it?
Yes.
That's the biggest thing here.
Mm-hmm. So he denied having the vehicle and explained that someone had done something out of violence to him with a knife. could whoever slashed the tires of Stephen Randolph been responsible for this attack? Could this have been someone mad about what he was doing? His girlfriend, Darren Curtis?
I mean, yeah, there's a lot of people that could have involvement. I mean, maybe we're getting it all wrong. I mean, maybe it's not necessarily
the most obvious.
Yeah, maybe it's not jealousy. Maybe it's just, I don't know. I'm taking like a weird angle on it. Like maybe it has something to do with the person's faith, you know, because they know what they're doing.
You're hooked on this.
I am a little bit.
The morality of it all.
Yeah, well, like I said, and it doesn't have to be Reeves, even though he's like the bishop. It could be somebody else.
Someone associated with his church, maybe. Yes,
it could, you know what I'm saying? Because maybe they know what's happening under the bishop's roof. And maybe
upset for him to take advantage
like,
of him.
Exactly. Like, oh, that can't be good for your image, the bishop. Look what's taking place.
Under your
that
roof.
Goes against the church, or that's not good. A good look. Like, it could be anything like that.
Okay.
So that's my odd angle on it, because it might not be jealousy. It could be someone's faith that's plaguing them with, you know, those ideals don't work well with them and they oppose it. So they kill her.
Well, Stephen Randolph said that he didn't know what was going on, but he thought that something really weird had been happening the past few weeks. He reported that he was getting weird blocked calls to his cell phone. And that they were really odd, like prank calls, but there seemed to be something a little bit more menacing to them. More than just your, like, harmless cell phone prank. Soon after he started getting those calls, his girlfriend got them as well, also from a blocked number. The detectives wondered if there was a connection between the slashed tire, the phone calls, and the murder. So now, at that moment in the investigation, the detectives had three viable suspects, and potentially a fourth. First, there was Darren Curtis, whose motive could have been the fact that his wife was having an affair, and the fact that he did not have an alibi made this case against him even stronger. Then there was Stephen Randolph, who had been the other man in Latrice's life. The mishap had happened with the condom, and maybe somehow, through him or maybe his girlfriend, the affair led to a heated argument that resulted in Latrice's death. Then lastly, there was Robert Reeves. Randolph had denied using the minivan that night, so how had it gotten parked behind Latrice's car on the side of I-540 in the middle of the night? This was still an unanswered question. But luckily, the web that had been weaved over the last few days of investigating was untangled by the advancements of science. DNA had been collected beneath the broken fingernails of the victim and from the sexual assault exam. And a set of fingerprints had been found on the steering wheel. The semen in the vaginal canal was a match for Stephen Randolph. But the DNA beneath Latrice's fingernails and the fingerprints on the steering wheel belonged to 43-year-old Robert Reeves.
What? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. No way. So, okay. So, I guess Stephen is telling the truth, and that story seems to be actually real.
Correct. Unfortunate, but correct.
Unfortunate, but correct. And now it is the bishop.
It's the bishop.
Oh, man. Wow. Wow. That is crazy.
I know.
Okay.
To say the very, very least, everyone and John was shocked about the arrest of the well-respected bishop. Those who knew him or attended his congregation said that they never thought him capable of violence. It was said that most people in his life never really even saw Reeves get angry. But he had been. He had been capable of the violent and callous murder of a 21-year-old woman. Another bishop from the same church Reeves had been at said the whole event changed the way he saw the world and trusted the people around him. It reveals to you that you never truly know what's going on in the minds of the people that we see every day, he had to say. Sherman and Cynthia had been called about the arrest of Robert Reeves. They cried and were devastated to learn additional details about their daughter's murder. But they rejoiced at the fact that her killer had been found so quickly. But it was confusing for all those who found out. Who was this man, and why'd he do this? Darren Curtis was equally surprised. He had learned through the investigation that his wife had been having an affair. So all of this news was really coming as a shock to him. It's really sad.
That is sad.
Another shocked party was the media. Because the district attorney's office and the Wake County Sheriff's Department did not reveal any details as to why Robert Reeves would have committed this murder. And the case would remain full of looming unanswered questions until it was all revealed to them at the trial of Robert Reeves, which began in the fall of 2009. On September 29th, 2009, the first thing the prosecutor in the case stated was that this is going to be a unique case, that the story she was about to weave for them would get strange and complicated quickly, but that she would do her best to explain to them the set of circumstances, details, and emotions that all led to the death of an intelligent, kind, and beautiful young woman. The prosecution had to thoughtfully present their case if they wanted the jury to understand it and make the connections that they wanted them to. The first person who was put on the stand was Darren Curtis, who testified to the kind of person Latrice was, how wonderful and intelligent she was, and how lucky he considered himself to be married to her. He was then questioned about the affair, and he admitted that there was a relationship that he had not known about with Latrice and one of her classmates. And the next person who spoke to the jury would be the other man in Latrice's life, Stephen Randolph. Through their own investigation, the investigators with the prosecutor's office and the detectives from the sheriff's department surmised that, as strange as it sounded, Randolph had been telling the truth. He and Latrice had engaged in consensual sex that night, but the condom remained inside of her because of an accident. It was a separate incident that was unrelated to the murder, which is crazy when it comes to the investigation of it all.
Right, because when I heard that, I really thought this guy's just trying to give a cover story as to why they would find that there.
Correct. And if that DNA hadn't been found beneath her fingernails or fingerprints on the steering wheel, he'd be in jail.
I think so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But that was not what Stephen Randolph was on the stand to talk about. Rather, he'd been called to testify about his landlord, Robert Reeves. Stephen Randolph explained that he had been in a pretty desperate situation when he met the bishop. Stephen Randolph explained that he had been in a pretty desperate situation when he met the bishop, as many people called Robert Reeves. He had been hard up for a place to live as he could afford nowhere to go in the expensive student housing areas of Durham. Reeves offered him a reduced rate in his basement apartment, and Randolph said he accepted it because he basically had to. It was either that or be without a place to live. He trusted Reeves because he seemed like a nice and well-respected man, especially one within the church community. However, he learned quickly that the man had not been honest about why he wanted him there as a tenant.
Okay.
As time went on, he said he began to see another side to Reeves that made him very nervous and uncomfortable. It was almost like he had become obsessed with him. In early December of 2007, about a month before the murder and a few weeks before Randolph's tires had been slashed, there was a particular incident that revealed the bishop's motives. Randolph said he had been talking to him about his lack of money and how frustrating it was, when Reeves suggested that maybe he do some work as a male escort.
What?
Randolph said that for a second he thought about it, because he heard you can make some good money. In some ways, Reeves implied that he had a connection to male escorts, and said, "Well, I have to see what you're working with first." And jokingly, Randolph pulled down his pants to reveal his penis. He said very quickly, Reeves told him that being an escort might mean that he would have to have sex with men as well. And he began to fondle him.
"I'm sorry. I thought you were the bishop. I don't think you should be doing that. I don't think you should be doing any fondling of any kind.
Nobody should be suggesting doing this.
Any kind of male prostitution of any kind when you're preaching any kind of..." Never mind. You get where I'm going.
Right. Well, what was implied was that he knew of male escorts and the services. Randolph said he quickly got away from the situation and he did not get angry, but he made it very clear that he didn't want to participate in any sexual acts with Reeves. However, after that, Reeves made it very clear that he had a sexual interest in Randolph, and he was quite open and aggressive about it. Randolph explained that he was very upset by this new scenario that he found himself in, because he had been vulnerable and needed a place to stay, and he thought Reeves was trying to help him out, but now he saw that he had ulterior motives. At that time, he couldn't move out of Reeves' home because he didn't have enough money to go anywhere else. So now he felt unsafe in the home that he lived in. So unsafe that he asked his cousin for a gun, which he slept with beneath his pillow.
That's crazy. And let me tell you, this guy knows that too.
He knows he has nowhere to go. It's a power imbalance, which makes this highly inappropriate.
On so many levels.
He said that Reeves propositioned him several more times after that incident. He tried to entice him in several ways. He told Randolph he would make his rent even cheaper. Randolph said he tried to do the right thing and remain respectful. He would tell him that he was not interested and that he was not gay. And Reeves would tell him that that doesn't matter. I won't say word for word what he said, but he basically said sexual acts are sexual acts. And he even told Randolph a story about a time where he was at a frat party and he closed his eyes and was receiving oral sex. But when he opened his eyes, it was a male and not a woman, but he still liked it. So he's trying to say this to Randolph to kind of say, this is okay, you could still do this even if you're not gay. And Randolph was still trying to tell him, no, I don't want to participate in this. He said on the stand that he always made it clear that it would never happen. There was no leading on of any sort here. Next, the detectives from the case testified to every road the investigation led down and how, once they knew it had been Reeves, they did some further dives and found out that the phone that had been given to them, as per the warrant that was served, was not the only phone that Robert Reeves had. He also had a phone registered with the church, and it was that phone that was used to call Stephen Randolph and his girlfriend from the blocked number.
Oh, okay.
So he was the phone calls that were happening, trying to intimidate Randolph and the girlfriend.
And also trying to be inconspicuous by
blocking it.
Blocking it, yep.
They also were able to determine that the phone had been in the location of Stephen Randolph's car when his tires had been slashed in December.
Oh my God.
So he had made him more reliant on himself.
Yes.
By slashing his car tires, knowing he couldn't afford to replace them and saying, well, now I'm giving you my car. You're going to have to pay me back.
So now I wonder now if he took it a step further and killed her. Because that would, unless he's really into him, I don't know.
To take away a romantic rival in his mind, even though that's a delusional thought, that's what he's thinking. He's thinking that Stephen Randolph's girlfriend and Latrice Curtis, whom he's having an affair with, these are his romantic rivals. So his delusion has gotten so far in this process that he's thinking, if I eliminate these women, he'll need me.
Now, I wonder if he would have gotten away with the murder of Latrice, if he would have eventually try to kill his actual girlfriend?
I don't know.
You know?
I don't know.
Because that still would be somebody in the way.
Somebody else.
In his delusional mind. Yeah.
I think, in my opinion, what had happened, and we'll get there. Obviously, there's so much left to talk about. Well, the intent to murder had to have been there because he took the knife with him. But was he just trying to scare her? And then when she was like, what the hell are you doing or talking about? That's when he then got aggressive and his anger came out, I guess.
This is shocking. It really is.
Oh, yeah. Finally came the expert witnesses, the coroner and the forensic scientist to explain all the physical and DNA evidence present. Reeves' DNA was beneath Latrice's fingernails and his prints on the steering wheel. And there would be no reason for that DNA to be there or the fingerprints. The defense claimed that the case was largely circumstantial and that they were speculating and putting the defendant's sexual preferences on full display as a distraction and for shock value. They also played on the fact that there had been no eyewitnesses to the killings. Also, to tie up the loose ends of the phone call, the detective still didn't know whether this was an accidental dial by Latrice during the fight or Reeves had done it while he was moving Latrice's body and phone to pose her the way he did on the hill.
Okay.
To conclude the case, the prosecution claimed that Robert Reeves was obsessed with Stephen Randolph and was jealous that he wanted others more than he wanted him. He believed that if he could make Randolph reliant on him, he could coerce him into a sexual relationship by helping him financially, by slashing his tires so he would need to use his vehicle. And when that was not enough, he thought getting rid of the females in Randolph's life would help. He prank called Randolph and his girlfriend, but something about that night in January made him follow Latrice Curtis. Maybe he was going to follow her home and threatened to tell her husband if she didn't stop seeing Randolph. But what he didn't count on was her stopping. She had the unfortunate situation of having to try and remove the condom before she got home. When she pulled to the side of the road, they are guessing that that's what she was trying to do, which was why her pants were unbuttoned and unzippered. But when she pulled off to the side of the road, Reeves got out. A confrontation took place somehow and in some way. And at some point they were away from their vehicles, but they don't know exactly what happened that night. But in the end, Latrice died because Robert Reeves believed she stood in the way of his delusionally expected relationship with Stephen Randolph. She was a threat to him.
Yeah, 100%. And it's just so crazy that this is a guy that's supposed to be helping the neighborhood. This is supposed to be the guy that's there every Sunday, that's there for his community. And I, once again, you know, the case that we covered, oh my God, I'm bad because I can't remember. But do you remember a long while back, it was the case where it was a pastor who was helping out a guy that fell on hard times?
Yes. It was a pastor that very much abused his relationship and the vulnerability of the person that he was trying to help. Yes.
But that was
very similar to this.
Very similar, yeah. At some point I was thinking like that's what triggered in my mind was that past case.
Yeah.
It kind of led me there. But I mean, this happens a lot.
Yes.
It's always the ones that say, "Oh, I'll help out the community. Oh, I do this and I do that." To me, it's a cover. It is the best cover when people, you know, want to do shady stuff.
Well, also sometimes when you are put into a position like that, you're given a certain amount of power. And sometimes people let that definitely get to their head and they abuse that power. And that's unfortunate because what that means is that's going to tarnish the name of that church who have no affiliation with what he did and really didn't even know him to be that person. So it's sad because so much faith is put into an individual who's a leader within church community. And that's why it's kind of like an ultimate betrayal.
It is. I mean, it really is some cloak and dagger stuff.
Yes.
You know, that's terrible.
Well, on October 9th, 2009, Robert Reeves was found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Latrice Curtis was only 21 years old. She was a senior in college, working towards an accounting degree, balancing school with a job and trying to build a future with a man she had married just 9 months earlier. Like so many of us in our early 20s, she wasn't perfect. She made decisions she may have regretted later, and she was navigating adulthood one day at a time. But those choices don't define her, and they certainly didn't determine what she deserved. The truth is, Latrice was never given the opportunity to make things right, to learn from mistakes, or to become the woman that she was working so hard to be. The chance was stolen from her by Robert Reeves. He made a choice fueled by obsession and jealousy, and in a matter of minutes, he took away a lifetime of possibilities, not only from Latrice, but from her husband, her parents, her friends, and everyone who loved her. Her story shouldn't be remembered for the mistakes she made, but for the life she was striving to build and the beautiful person she was, and the future she was never allowed to have.
It's really sad. And, you know, we didn't even really talk about the family again, but, you know, this is heartbreaking for them, and for them to find out all of this too must be so heartbreaking, yeah. You know, like all of it. And they thought the whole time that it was, they surely thought it was Darren.
It just is sad because, like I said, she had so much potential and she was such a beautiful person. She was 21 years old. She was, you know, she probably got into that marriage and was like, oh my gosh, did I make a mistake? You know, let me try this. And, you know, she realized she really did want to be with Darren and that she wanted to eventually start a family with him, but she was getting herself out of any situation that she may have been getting herself into. But for her to be murdered because of that is so incomprehensible, because when you think of the reasoning behind why she was murdered, it's just so devastating.
Yeah, and it's extremely left field. You would think yes. it was out of jealousy that the husband maybe found out and caught them or something.
And that she pulled off to the side of the road and then he got her.
That's crazy.
It's insane.
And honestly, like, you know, look, we all do things that we're not proud of sometimes. And, you know, we're always growing, always improving.
It doesn't define us.
No, she was 21 years old.
The person I was at 21 isn't the person I am at 36.
100%. Same here. I mean, 21 me and 34 me. I mean, that's...
But you never know the people that are involved with the other people in your life. It's like, not only do you have to think, okay, who am I involving myself with, but who's on their periphery?
And exactly.
The fact that she was murdered because of this obsession with somebody else is...
And had no idea.
Unthinkable. Had no idea.
Right. Like that inner circle... You think your inner circle is okay, but you don't know, like you said, who's out on the periphery. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we can't wait to hear what you guys have to say about this case, because this was a shocking one, and I'm sure your reactions were all very similar to the one that John had. But before we go, we want to thank our newest supporters on Patreon. So thank you to Samantha Ryan, Anne Pike, Chantel Royster, Jessica Gondek, Sophie, Lindy, Anastasia, Meredith Slaughter, Rhonda Simpkins, Mary Beth, Anna Martoriana, April Huey, Katie Feliciano, Raquel Hamilton, Stephanie Kellogg, Alita Button, Allie, Cassandra Dunsmore, Dina Pope, Leticia Cipriano, Amy Meredith Slaughter, Tammy Fogel, Craig Holden, and Anthony. Thank you so much for joining. And until next time, guys, don't park next to vans.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com.
Got it.
Step 2. Collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step 3. Play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games. All for free?
Step 4. Unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.